Hi, hello, and welcome to a special edition of the Dunker Spot. We are part of the Yahoo Sports Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, joined as always by my guy, the always excellent Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are we doing? It's play-in week, lots of things happening. How are we feeling?
Feeling good, feeling great. Happy to be here, excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. Ready to talk some awards.
There we go. Got a little extra soft this week. Normally we save, you know, the final Friday or something heading into the end of the regular season. We want to get our awards thought. But since we had so much to discuss on the NBA side, we also had W free agency to account for. We wanted to make sure we had something on the awards front. So we pushed that to this week. And that is what this is for. We want to talk through our fake ballots, what we would have if we had official ballots in lieu of the 65 game rule, et cetera. But we got some news earlier today, as we were trying to finalize what our fake ballots were going to be. And that is Luka Doncic and Cade Cunningham looked like they were going to be on pace to be ineligible as they fell below 65 games. Luka, as he missed two games earlier this year for the birth of his child. Cade Cunningham dealing with this collapsed lung. Both now eligible for awards this year. So I would imagine we're going to see them on MVP ballots. I would imagine we're going to see them on All-NBA first team or just All-NBA ballots overall. They won their appeals on that front. And so, Steve, just broadly, what were your takeaways from the ruling? Are you happy that this got done? Do you think we're going to see more of this moving forward? Like, how did you kind of soak this news in?
I was told that you had words to say about this at the start of the show. That's the text message I received from you to peel the curtain back. So what were your thoughts on it?
I said I had thoughts, and I do indeed have thoughts. And so I guess for me, one, I am happy for Cade and Luka, who very clearly performed at MVP levels this year. And I'm glad that in a literal sense that their seasons are going to be memorialized, whether that is both of them ending up in the top five on MVP ballots, if they both make all NBA first teams, that would be my predictions, but we'll see if anyone slides to the second team. They were tremendous all year long. And so I am glad that they are getting recognized for that. So I start there.
And there we go. And that's the story. That's the end of the sentence. Let's roll through the rest of the show, right? There's no but, is there?
Kind of. Less a but and more so and also. Because as I zoom out with this, and I tweeted this immediately as the news was broken, where is the line going to be drawn when it comes to how many players are appealing, what they can appeal for, and what is ultimately going to be accepted in this case? I think for the Luka one, again, happy that his MVP caliber season is going to be celebrated. On top of that, Luka getting this ruling as he was missing for like childbirth, I think that bodes well moving forward. I don't think players should have to think about potentially being quote unquote punished in award season because they want to be active parents. Like, I think there's a broader societal conversation to have about that just being more acceptable. But within this lens, I am glad that Luka is getting that exception. The Cade one is where the brow raised a little bit. And this is where a collapsed lung is not a twisted ankle. A collapsed lung is not a sprained wrist. It is not a normal basketball injury. And so I understand where the logic comes from. And from The Athletic, as they had a piece come out shortly after the ruling, as part of this piece, it says a leaked source told The Athletic that Cunningham's injury was considered a condition as opposed to a basketball injury, and that was part of the analysis of the situation. And so, again, I understand where that logic comes in. And so I just kind of wonder, as there's been a lot of rumblings over the last couple of months about the 65-game rule being amended in some way heading into the offseason or removed altogether, we'll see which one they land. If it is more of it being amended, I feel like that wording is going to have to get in there in some capacity. And so I was going to wonder, like, if it's collapsed lung or any kind of heart issue, if we get into, like, blood clots or anything like that, are those injuries going to be this is the box that this is in? This injury count, this is an extraordinary circumstance. All these injuries fall underneath this bucket, and it's easy to accept or deny when it comes to appeals and things like that. Will they have that in? Will they not? Because I think without having that kind of structured in or layered in, it does leave a level of gray area, because as we are celebrating, rightfully so, Luka Doncic and Cade Cunningham being eligible, Anthony Edwards also filed an appeal and that was declined. So like there is clearly a line. Yeah. And so establishing what that line is and having that in writing where both sides agree to, I think that's going to be important moving forward if this is going to be amended versus the rules being taken away altogether.
Or we should just get rid of the rule that was never necessary in the first place. I think that's a great idea. Just get it out of here. Didn't need it. I mean, I'm not attached to arguing over the semantics of the injury. I think Kay Cunningham had a very unique circumstance in the sense that, hey, yo, bro, I collapsed my lung. I mean, that is fair. You probably would have made it had you not. Hey, remember that player participation policy you guys wanted? I played against the Wizards and collapsed my lung 5 minutes in. They didn't get some grace over here. Also, I mean, there's you never know. You know, personal reasons, things could happen. Injuries could be listed. Other things could happen. But we don't know. We don't know the information. So salute to Kay for getting recognized. Salute to Luka for getting recognized. I did find it funny. Anthony was like, oh, y'all appealing? Me too. And the league was like, no. Not you. But my knee. We know.
It's not you. But like that's where I'm just kind of like, what lines are going to be drawn here to make sure that everyone has a better understanding of what is and what isn't? Like, I don't, again, looking at what happened to Kay, I don't disagree that that is extreme. It is just with the ruling and the wording that we have right now, it feels like there's a little bit of gray area. So my thing is like, can you close that heading into this offseason? Because like my initial thought after, oh, that's dope for them, what's going to happen here? My mind immediately went to the 23-24 season, Drew Smith, when he got injured in Cleveland, where he's closing out on the three, slips. As you know, like the Cleveland court is kind of raised. He ends up suffering an ACL injury because of his leg kind of getting caught in that area. And I'm just like, okay, so would that classify as an extraordinary experience if someone else got hurt in Cleveland, as Luka Doncic got hurt, wasn't fully injured, but got hurt earlier in January with a similar bit, took a step back three, was backpedaling after taking the three, slip, got caught with their court being lifted. And it's like, ooh, this doesn't seem great. To the point where the NBA in Cleveland was like, hey, can we do something about the court? Can we get to some kind of resolution to where we don't have these instances happening again, et cetera? And so I'm just like, okay, if something like that happens to a player in March, and then they're now, their eligibility is now in flux, would that count? Or would it not? Like, these are things that I'm just kind of like, okay, what are we going to do with it?
For the 127th time on this podcast, life is gray. It's black and white doesn't exist.
I'm just saying. That's where I've become curious. So let's see. We'll see what happens on that front. But salute to Luka Doncic and Kay Cunningham. And that certainly makes MVP ballots a little bit easier in terms of who the names are going to be, I would imagine. So let's get into the fun stuff, Steve. Let's talk about these awards, who we would have if we had ballots. We can start with MVP. I'll go first. As I am fresh off of writing three, it would have been four, but Luka Doncic's case was just kind of up in the air. We were waiting on wording on the appeal. But over the last week or so, wrote a deep dive on Shea's MVP case, Jokic's MVP case, Wemby's MVP case. Already kind of felt like all three of these guys had really strong cases for one. I wouldn't be upset if either one of them won it. After getting into the weeds with some of the film and some of the numbers, like, oh, snap. So these cases are even stronger if you really lay this thing out. And so very stressful, very time consuming, but it was kind of informative for me to really lay bare what these cases are. And I feel like I would have came to a very similar place had I written the Luka piece as was planned before he got hurt. But for me, I landed with Shea at one. I went Jokic two. I went Wemby three. I have Luka four, and I have Kay Cunningham five, as those two are now eligible for the awards bid. And I get to my reasons why, but that would be my five. Steve, who would you have as your five?
I have the same five.
Oh, that's funny. Okay. Well, that's fantastic. Yeah. Okay. I guess, well, the question I'll ask you then, since we have the same ballot, for me, like I ultimately landed on Shea. I felt like I had more of a struggle with Jokic versus Wemby than I did with like Jokic versus Shea or Wemby versus Shea. Were you similar in that, or was it a pretty straightforward 1-2-3 for you as you kind of came to that top three?
I mean, I think it was pretty straightforward 1-2-3. These were my five names that I had. It got interesting when Luka and Kate were just ineligible there for a minute. But these were the five names I thought were the five players who kind of separated themselves in different ways. I think for me, you could argue Wemby two, you could argue Jokic two or three or one. Like, I think it's a tough race. They all had very impactful seasons. I think for me, when it comes down to it, when you're talking just about Shea, like, he just did a whole lot of things and the league didn't have a lot of answers for what he did on a night-to-night basis. You know what I mean? You don't end up being the first guard in NBA history to average 30-plus points shooting 55% from the field. I know we don't love box score numbers, but that's still not how that's supposed to work. That's video game adjacent type behavior. Being able to have a low turnover rate with such a high responsibility for the Oklahoma City offense and being able to have counters, and I can get to my straight line drive, I can get to my jump shot, the playmaking has improved. So if you want to put two on the ball, you want to double me, I can make the right reads, get off it quick, and now you still have to deal with me being able to control this, where I'm going. I can get to the step back three. I can get you off balance, and now I'm turning the corner and finishing. Straight line drives are tough. So he did so much, I think, consistently all year long, hard to take away from him. Jokic, first player in NBA history to lead the league in rebounds per game and assists per game. Like, that's not how it's supposed to work. And I think when it comes to Jokic, you can go offense against defense with how Wemby impacted the game, but Jokic, just his ability to just control what happened for Denver consistently, in the sense that doesn't really matter how you're covering me, I'm going to score, and now I'm going to make you make a decision, and we're going to profit off of that over and over and over again. Like, that to me, especially with how Denver was able to surge towards the end of the season, you know, up and down the year, tried a lot of different things. They end up closing 12 straight. Now we're healthy. You know, they had success without Jokic, but Jokic was a big reason why they were able to be in that position. So you got to salute him. And then with Wemby, I think the only thing missing is probably the offensive mastery that the other two displayed. Defensively, we know what he did all season long, as far as being in command, being in control, rotating, operating, communicating defensively, taking things away. We said that ad nauseum. But it's like, okay, I think the other two impact the game so heavily to where you have to make a decision, but I'll put you three. Luka was tremendous all season long, consistent, on fire there towards the end before he got hurt. And then it's hard to ignore what Cade Cunningham did for the Pistons. I mean, if we're talking about the only players that average 23, 9, and 5, it's Jokic and Cade. And so that's not like an easy thing to produce, no matter what era you are in the NBA. It's a short list of people that have done that. So being able to be that kind of rock for a Detroit Pistons team all season long, that's where I ended up putting K5.
Okay. I think the Wemby piece was a real inflection point, as our coworker Kevin O'Connor recently wrote a piece detailing why Shea was number one for him until Wemby kind of came undeniable for him. And I think the offense is what holds a lot of people back to making that kind of leap. I think it's the combination of the offense compared to what Shea did, the consistency, and everything that Jokic did. In addition to, Shea's played like 400 more minutes. Jokic just played like 300 or something more minutes, et cetera. Like, there's just an availability piece that Wemby is behind on. You average an efficient 25. You close the game, you close the season out with multiple 40-point games. You threaten defenses with your rolling to a degree that you unlock a whole lot of driving lanes for whoever's initiating a ball screen with Wemby. In addition to, like, the corner to drop up, like, that offensive impact was very loud as well. So I'm fascinated by how the actual tally is going to come out when it comes to Wemby. Because I think he had, as I was doing this, he had a stronger case for one than I kind of anticipated. And that's someone that I figured was going to be in my top three. But as I got to the offense, I was like, oh, no, this is actually, you could build a really strong bit around his offensive impact, too.
Well, I think, you know, I wrote about it earlier that he has grown offensively as far as being able to establish position, but also I'm going to drive and hit first. I'm going to try and get to my spots and get to the shots I want to. I'm going to find a comfort with physicality and try and finish over and through it, as opposed to purely just getting bumped off. And so I think when you take into inventory what he's been able to do offensively, growth-wise, it shouldn't be ignored. It's just not necessarily currently at the level of those two where, hey, make a play. Not that he hasn't shown that he can do it, but that's probably the one thing that's missing to take him to the level where it's like, well, what do we do with this guy? So that's where I landed.
Okay, understood. Well, from there, let's flow into these all NBA teams. Steve, you'll be proud this year with Luka and Kate being eligible now. My top five in MVP is also just my top five for the all NBA first team. I will say, if those two weren't eligible, I was anticipating some hijinks. There was going to be a slight shift MVP ballot compared to my All-NBA first team ballot, which I've done before. I've explained that on the pod before. I weighed winning a little heavier with MVP than I do with All-NBA, et cetera. But I think we both have the same All-NBA first team. So let's start with the second team. And I'll let you lead the dance on this one. Who is your All-NBA second team? Or who would it be?
Well, we've gone back and forth before. Your MVP ballot should likely be your first team ballot, but I'm not going to hang there too long. What got interesting was the debate I had when Luka and Cade were not available. And it kind of became this like triple threat match between Jaylen Brown, Donovan Mitchell, and Kevin Durant. Mm-hmm. And trying to figure out, okay, I felt good, Jaylen Brown, you could be four. Now who is five? My second team is pretty much built of those guys now, so I'm good. So I have Jaylen Brown on the second team. I have Donovan mm-hmm. Mitchell on the second team. I have Kevin Durant. I have Kawhi Leonard, and I have Tyrese Maxey. I just think those were undeniably consistent, strong pieces for their team, who I don't know if they're the same if they don't play at this high of a level.
Mm-hmm. You know, I love that. I love that. I think we have four of the same. We have four of the five names on the slight difference at the end. I'll just very quickly say, like, one, Jaylen Brown is there. The consistent scoring, slight growth as a playmaker, just him setting the table for Boston the way they did and keeping them afloat with the consistent drives, with the pull-up shooting early on, even as some of the efficiency tailed off as the year went on. Going into a Boston game knowing this guy is going to hit me in my chest on drives, he's going to give me 25 to 30 every night while at least competing on the defensive end, is that shouldn't be taken for granted. And so salute to Jaylen Brown for the season he had. I wanted to say quickly, Kevin Durant, 26-6-5 this year, 57% on twos. And as I was writing the Jokic MVP piece, one of the things I wanted to highlight was not only was Jokic super efficient inside the arc, when you look at what his shot difficulty was, contest level, how far out they were, those things, and second spectrum tracks, like expected shot efficiency based on all of those different factors, Jokic naturally was towards the top of the list. One of the few names that edged Jokic out in terms of exceeding what you were supposed to do was Kevin Durant. It's not supposed to look the way it made it look with the overall workload that he had, with the minute load that he had this year, which I feel like has kind of gone under the radar. Not only has Houston needed him to be good, they've needed him to be good for 36, 37, 38, 39, sometimes 40 minutes a night, while also being confident at minimum, defensively. Either on-ball assignments, putting him on centers to switch sometimes, some of the weak side roaming that he could do. He was very important for this Houston Rockets team. I know early in the year we had like some minor Şengün versus KD, who's been more impactful early on. KD, as the season went on, like very loudly answered that. Because you were KD. You were on the KD. We had conversations, yes. You were on the KD side. Early on, I was on the Şengün side. But as the season went on, KD very loudly answered that. And like he has since slammed the door on that discussion, in my opinion. But he's just had a tremendous year. So I'm glad we both have him there. Donovan Mitchell, tremendous season. All those numbers are also off the charts if you care about that kind of thing, but the consistent scoring was there. The only shift that we had, or the only split that we had when it came to the All-NBA second team, you went Tyrese Maxey, who was the first name I have written down on my third team. I went Jamal Murray. Also Murray piece, Kawhi Leonard, what a season it was, and wild end to his season in the play-in. But as we know, play-in games do not count towards the regular season and thus don't factor into award stuff. But Kawhi, metronome on offense as well. I want to make sure I give him his love. I went Jamal Murray slightly ahead of Tyrese Maxey. Career year for Jamal Murray. Lethal inside the arc. Best three-point shooting season of his career with volume. Love seeing him take more pull-up threes. And I think you saw during the Jokic-less stretch, the ownership that he was able to take of that offense was something that we've seen in stretches, we've seen during postseason runs. For him to kind of come out that way out of the gates during the regular season and to be able to hold serve while Jokic was out was super impressive to me. The clutch play, which we'll also get to a little bit later in this episode, was very strong for Jamal Murray as well. So that's where he got my nod over Tyrese Maxey, but not at all mad at a second-team selection from Maxey. The third team. As I have Tyrese Maxey, I have Jalen Brunson. I did have a lot of internal debate between Brunson and Karl-Anthony Towns as the Knicks rep. Because I think the Cat All-NBA case is probably going to go a little bit under the radar because of how loud the noise was around what is Cat doing against switches, how comfortable is Cat within the offense. Valid things to bring up. But he ended up having a really good season. Anyway, landed on Jalen Brunson there. My last three names on the All-NBA third team. I have Jalen Duren. I have Chet Holmgren. I have Bam Adebayo. With a lot of honorable mentions aside from those five. But that's where I landed. Steve, any early issues with those five? And who did you have on you?
No, I don't have issues. I mean, I think the fun of doing this exercise, and again, the wrinkle of Luka and Kay not being available made it really interesting because you had to widen that list out and try and have different inflection points. And so I went back and forth on so many guys on that third team towards the end. And eventually I was like, I have to make a decision. But I went Jalen Duren. I went Jalen Brunson. I went Jalen Johnson. I went Jamal Murray. I went Karl Anthony Towns. But I had Chet down at a certain point. I had Scotty Barnes down at a certain point. I had Bam Adebayo down at a certain point. I don't think you'd really go wrong, which I know people don't love to hear, but there's been so much talented play in this league so far this season. I'm like, I got to give a salute to Jalen Johnson. I mean, I know people may not enjoy points, rebounds, and assists as much as maybe they used to, but like 22, 10, and almost 8, that's not really normal behavior. I think the only people to do 22, 10, and 7 are Oscar Robertson, Wilt Chamberlain, Nikola Jokic, and Russell Westbrook. It's a pretty elite company. So I salute him for the efforts he made this season.
No, I think that's fair. Like Jalen Johnson was someone that I thought a ton about. You mentioned Scotty Barnes already. And you keep going down the list of names. Like LaMelo Ball was someone that factored in a lot more heavily as I was digging down to kind of finalize my list, as it would have been earlier this year, as he was dealing with his injuries, minutes restriction, things like that. Efficiency perked up as the year went on, ultimately lands at like a 54 true shooting in addition to everything else. So that plus minutes, I had to split hair somewhere. But like LaMelo was someone that I was like, ooh, impact metrics love him if you care about that kind of thing. And you see what he means to the Charlotte offense in particular, the pace, the shot creation, the playmaking, everything that he means for that Charlotte group. So like he was someone else that I thought about there. A stronger offensive finish to the season. I think Scottie Barnes is just in over Bam, but I think anchoring the defense the way that Bam did, even through the slide to close out the season with Bam on the floor, they still very much performed as a high level unit. And so I didn't want the last few weeks to take over or, you know, compensate for what he did throughout the entire year. Offense certainly perked up. He started average 83. That was impressive as well. But having the shift within Miami's offensive ecosystem, very impressive to me. But there are just a lot of names here. I'm sure Derek White's going to get a couple of shouts. Scoring efficiency wasn't there, but literally everything else was certainly there for him. So that's going to be a fun one. So I'm curious to see how those teams land as well. But those were the names, Steve. Those were the names. Also, interesting, you landed with both Jalen Brunson and Karl Anthony Towns. It's funny, I was debating one or the other. But I like that. I like that. We can move to Defensive Player of the Year. Let's shift to the defense side. Is it fair to say that we both have Victor Wembanyama at one? Do
correct.
We need to spend 10 minutes explaining why Victor Wembanyama is your Defensive Player of the Year? Okay, fair enough. Well, let's get into second on the ballot and third on the ballot. Steve, who did you have 2 and 3?
Asar Thompson and Derek White.
Okay.
I had Asar Thompson and Derek White. Those were my 2 and 3. And so I was thinking about Chet Holmgren, thinking about Bam Adebayo. Okay. They made my first team all defense, but I think Asar Thompson's consistency for that Detroit team, being able to guard anybody and everyone and cause havoc and be a key part of their rotations and have that impact on ball, off ball, I think was huge for them. And I think Derek White did so much defensively for Boston. Like, we want to give Boston a lot of credit for their consistency all year. Derek White did anything he needed him to do defensively, nailed every rotation, protecting the rim, pressuring the ball. And so for me, those are the top three that I went with. What say you, guys? Who are your 2 and 3?
Ooh, wait. Okay, so slight difference for me. But we are thinking about the same name, so I love that we're at least reasonably on the same page here. Wemby 1, I have Chet Holmgren 2. If you are anchoring the best defense in basketball with a little bit of a gap, like, you are going to catch my eye just at a baseline level. But then again, digging into what he actually did as a rim protector, what he did on late switches, the on-off differential, if you care, however much you want to factor that part in, for an Oklahoma City defense that has a ton of really good defenders, Chet, that moved the needle for them, and is because he's 7 foot in the shot blocker, etc. It's also like one of their more unique defensive talents among having a bunch of unique defensive talent there. So Chet got the nod from me at 2. Just quiet as kept, like, just looking at what the opponent shoot when attacking the rim against insert player, like Chet with a lower number than Wemby, like, that moves me. Now you get into some of the rim deterrents, like, we're not attacking Wemby as often in terms of like the percentage of shots at the rim, but Chet was insane. And as I talked, we had our all conversation. I didn't know what was going to happen with Asar Thompson at that time because he had played more than 65 games, but he hadn't logged like 65 of the games with 20 plus minutes, et cetera. But I said on the pod, I said in writing, if Asar is eligible, like he is going to factor into my DPOY ballot. He is going to be all defense first team. So very pleased to announce that Asar Thompson did indeed get there by the end of the regular season. And thus he is number three for me with all due respect to Derek White, to Bam Adebayo, to Rudy Gobert as well. To Scottie Barnes, for that matter. I think you had a lot of people you could argue in that like 3 to 5 range. But Asar Thompson was so freaking good, man. Took on so many different assignments. If you needed high ball pressure, you could do that. If you wanted him to lay off and then catch you on a drive and then cut off your drive, he could do that. The weak side rim protection was there. If you're talking about needle movers for this Detroit group, it's easy to point at Cade Cunningham offensively. Defensively, it was just Asar Thompson. He was just the guy that mucked things up and changed life for them. So wanted to give him his respect there. He lands at three, but again, other guys in consideration. So, Steve, who would be your complete first team and second team for all defense? Then we could talk.
First team, Victor Wembanyama, Asar Thompson, Derek White, Chet Holmgren, and Bam Adebayo on the second team for me. Did not have fun putting this together, but got there eventually ready to get booed. Dyson Daniels, Kaysen Wallace, Amen Thompson, Rudy Gobert, and Stephon Castle.
Ooh, okay. Okay. I think all very good defenders. I can think of one name that is going to get you booed at the very least. And it's more so like them not being on versus like booing someone you actually selected because you were selected from very good defenders. But okay, fascinating. First and second team for me, then we can get into the players for a little bit. Wemby, Asar Thompson, or Wemby, Chet Holmgren, Asar Thompson, Derek White, who's just insane on and off the ball for an elite Boston defense. And then I have Rudy Gobert, Edge got Bam Adebayo. And then on the second to have Bam, Scotty Barnes is there for me, which I think is our main difference between our two lists. Dyson Daniels, Kaysen Wallace, and I have Stephon Castle on the second team as well. And so my initial question for you, Steve, is how or what kind of swung Amen Thompson for you over Scotty Barnes or whoever was your last cut or whoever the Scotty
Barnes was. My toughest cut was OG Anunoby, to be honest with you. That was my Paolo Banchero All-NBA from like 2 years ago where I was like, oh, surely OG's going to be on this team. And I was like, well, talked my way out of it. I think for me, it's easy to kind of give Amen Thompson the stamp defensively last year and then just remove it this year. But I don't know if that tells the full story of what he did defensively for Houston and the things he's asked to do. And so for me, Scotty Barnes made a huge leap defensively. So I wouldn't even argue against him being an all-defense team. I just think for me, there's a consistency and trust factor that I felt. And so with Scotty Barnes, he was able to guard multiple positions. He was able to make sure he nailed every rotation. So I don't argue against it. I think for me, the impact of what Amen was doing felt a little bit stronger at times over the course of the season.
Okay. I think to your Amen point, I think any of the stamp removing for Amen, who I think people still recognize as an elite defender, for me, it at least felt like the impact was a little bit muted because he had to do so much more offensively. And I think in general, it is very difficult to take on not even just primary score duties. In general, if you were taking on more initiation and just more on-ball responsibility, it is hard to do that while also defending number ones on the other end. And that's where you saw, like, sometimes it's Tari Eason defending number one. Sometimes it's Josh Okogie when he was starting, taking number ones. But Amen Thompson always had the ability, and when necessary, Ime Udoka was not afraid to say, okay, Amen, it is your turn to guard number one. These guys are not cutting it, or we just need to stop. You are a special defender. We need you to do that. And so for him to still be able to ramp to that degree and still have the off-ball value that he has, like, I think he very strongly has an all-defense case. And I love the OG Anunoby shout, who was also an honorable mention for me. Quiet as kept was very close to, like, not being eligible, looking at some of the minutes and some of the injuries and things. He was very close. I think he was right at 65 after factoring everything in. But, okay, just wanted to get your Scotty thoughts because he was pretty firmly in for me with that versatility and anchoring what was a top 10 defense for Toronto and everything he was asked to do while also having that kind of a higher initiation load, I would argue, than Amen Thompson, for that matter, and still putting that together. So that's where we differ a little bit there. Want to shout out OG Anunoby. Want to shout out to Monte Kamara. Want to shout out Nemeas Keita, Jaden McDaniels, Chris Dunn, a few other guys that were in heavy consideration for me. Again, rolled an all-defense piece March 27th, I want to say. So a lot of those names are still there. Marcus Smart, one of the names that is just ineligible now, ended with 62 games, but also had a tremendous defensive season. But there we go. Let's move to the rookie section, Steve. Who do you have as the rookie of the year? What would that rookie of the year ballot look like?
Oh, I know people are going to yell and scream and fight over this, but I think it's a very unique battle that was at the top. Like, I think Cooper Flagg was handed a ton of responsibility, and he took his bumps and responded with force. And I think Colin Knipple displayed an unexpected level of consistency for a better-than-expected Hornets team. And so, you know, Colin Knipple, first rookie to lead the NBA in total made threes, and we saw the type of offensive player that Cooper Flagg grew into in the second half of the season. I think it's more so the fact that they're have cases against each other in the same year that makes it interesting. I went with Colin Knipple 1, I went Cooper Flagg 2, I went BJ Edgecombe 3. I think, okay, you know, Colin was just a metronome for the Hornets as far as being able to raise their floor. You know, LaMelo Ball and Brandon Miller were huge, but his movement allowed them to have a consistent flow on the court. You know, his ability to improve, not just knock down shots, but drive, add some playmaking, be physical. It just gave them a base to a degree. And so it's no shade at Cooper Flagg, who I thought had a fantastic season, and the growth he had as a playmaker, as far as, you know what, there's no hesitation, I'm making reads, I'm getting to this left hand, I'm driving, I'm finishing, I'm playing, and you have to deal with me. That's not usual in a rookie campaign. So do you value the impact of winning that's not normally involved in rookie of the year, or do you involve are you inspired by the fact that a player grew to an incredible degree and produced high level results? I don't think you can go wrong. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like I say, these are these two are going to get all of the first place votes, I would imagine, or all but like one or two if we get like Philly media saying, hey, BJ Edgecombe helped this team make all the injuries and things. I feel like with Con, or I guess one to answer my own question, I went Con, Cooper Flagg, BJ Edgecombe as well. I feel like people that aren't watching Charlotte consistently kind of treated, if you were arguing for Cooper Flagg, which he just has his own strong case. Let me lay that out first. I feel like there was a tendency sometimes to kind of treat the Cooper Flagg season and the Cooper Flagg context kind of like Keegan Murray in Sacramento in his rookie year, to where like you are knocking down a bunch of threes, but you are kind of purely off the ball and you're not really doing much else in terms of self-creation. Like, Colin Knipple had to handle the ball quite a bit. Like, he was part of their double drag stuff, not just as a screener and flaring out to the wing and causing problems. Like, he was initiating those too. You hit on the drives and some of the inside the arc creation overall. Like, he did a good bit of creating. It wasn't just spot-up three-point shooting for him. And so I don't want that to be lost. In addition to, the Hornets did win, and they are still playing for the season again. Playing games don't count. But tremendous year. Efficiency off the charts for what he was asked to do and who he was guarded by at times, especially with LaMelo Ball, Brandon Miller missed some time as well. Just an incredible rookie season. Cooper Flagg was phenomenal. The way he closed the year, he peaked higher than Colin Knipple. I think that is a very fair thing to say. If you're talking about two-way impact, like, I certainly trust him defensively more than I do Colin. But I have him there, BJ Edgecombe, number three. And so let's flow to the all-rookie team, Steve. I would imagine we have the same top three at the very least. Who rounded out your first team and who would be on your second team?
On top of the top three, I would have Dylan Harper and Cedric Coward on the first team. Second team, Maxime Reyneaux, Jeremiah Fears, Colin Murray-Boyles, Derek Queen, and Ace Bailey.
Okay. I like it. Well, we have the same first team. I also have Dylan Harper, Cedric Coward. Second team, some slight differences. I think we both have Maxime Reyneaux. We both have Ace Bailey. We both have Murray Boyles. I think we both have Derek Queen. And I was trying to decide I wanted to have two Pelicans in terms of Derek Queen and Jeremiah Fears, or any of the other assortment of like impact rookies that were on good teams and had a role and executed it. Like, we've talked about Hugo Gonzalez before. Ryan Kalkbrenner was someone that I had early on in the year, and this has kind of been lurking around this conversation. I ended up going Kalkbrenner for my final second team spot. If you're asking me to predict what the actual ballots are going to be, I think Jeremiah Fears is going to get the spot over Ryan Kalkbrenner. But like, I really appreciated the screening, the interior scoring, the shot contesting, the shot blocking for a team that is playing for something. But Jeremiah Fears closed the season out with a 40 ball. Like, he really made strides as the season went on. So not going to be upset at all there. He was probably my biggest honorable mention there, in addition to Trey Johnson, some other guys to be mentioned. But okay, those are the rookie awards, Steve. Let's move to sixth man of the year. Who would be your top three?
Jaime Jaquez Jr., Keldon Johnson, Reed Shepherd for me.
Okay, so we have two of the three names, different order with those two names. So I am fascinated. I went Keldon Johnson one. I went Jaime Hawkins Jr. second. And then the third spot, Steve, to peel the curtain back, I don't know if you were in the doc as I was trying to type out my third person just in case we were going to have graphic names, graphics made or anything like that. I legit cycled through like five different names in the third spot as I was trying to solidify who do I want to complete this. So good about Keldon versus Jaime, and I ultimately landed on Keldon, where Jaime was kind of leading the season for me for most of the year. But like I landed on Tim Hardaway Jr. as my third. He meant a lot to this Denver offense in terms of what they wanted to run, the overall shot making, the three-point shooting was obviously loud, and he shot at a very high clip on very high volume. But in the midst of all the injury flux, his shot making felt even more important, and he held up defensively in a way that I just did not anticipate Tim Hardaway Jr. to do. So like that also weighed for me. But man, either Nas or Io in Minnesota, you could have the conversation there. Get to somebody to pick an OKC guy. If you want that to be AJ Mitchell, if you want that to be Alex Caruso, like you have a lot of different options on that front. A lot of fun defensive cases. I thought about Mitchell Robinson for a little bit. His impact, ultimately 60 total games, 44 games off the bench, couldn't get there in terms of total volume, but his impact as a rebounding defender was high for me. Just a lot of names that I was sorting through there, but ultimately landed on Tim Hardaway Jr. Steve, who is your most improved player? And who would you top three?
I have Ryan Rollins three, Jalen Duren two, Nikhil Alexander Walker one. Cannot wait for people to go Jalen Duren, Jalen Johnson, Amen Thompson, Brandon Miller. Can't wait for that.
Oh, I think the injury is going to take Brandon Miller out. I don't think there's going to be an Amen Thompson year, though. I think people need to investigate more closely what he's done for like the last 3.5-4 months. But we have the same three names. We have a different order, which is fun. Jalen Duren one for me. The scoring, in particular, the drives and the face-up growth for him. Took made strides defensively as well. All-star. I anticipate he's going to be an All-NBA guy this year as well. He gets the nod. Nikhil Alexander-Walker scaling back up to being a scorer while also taking on tough defensive assignments sometimes. Him and Dyson Daniels splitting those duties. Very impactful season for him on both ends of the floor. Ryan Rollins was my third player. Not a lot to smile about in Milwaukee these days. Ryan Rollins was one of those reasons. It is not easy to scale up the way that he did. On ball and off the ball, take on playmaking duties, deal with Giannis being out, and still have the efficient season that he had. So that's where I land with most improved player. Jalen Johnson was a fun shout. A lot of honorable mentions we can get into there. Last two, Steve, we got coach of the year. We got clutch player of the year. For coach of the year, who did you have?
Well, it's very interesting. There's a lot of different cases. I was talking about it online as far as how you could split this, and you have coaches that had high expectations but had to figure a lot out. So salute to Mike Brown and David Adelman and J.J. Redick because they did great jobs. Charles Lee and Jordan Ott taking young teams to different places. I stuck with the no one thought you would be this good and you've done it all year category. And so I had Joe Mazzulla three, I had Mitch Johnson two, and I had J.B. Bickerstaff one. And I had flip-flopped on Mazzulla and Mitch Johnson, depending on the day. But for me, J.B. Bickerstaff, getting the most out of his team, getting Detroit at 60 wins, getting them to the top of the Eastern Conference, having them play with this consistent identity all season long, no matter who was out there on the court, I think it speaks volumes. I have a feeling Joe Mazzulla will get the nod, which is funny because he didn't get it when he won all those games in Boston because they're like, your team was already good. Hard because Mark Dadno also won 64 games, and it's not like OKC had an easy year. So I had head in hands, but those coaches being able to tap into this team and get them to elevate their play all season long when unexpected was huge.
Yeah, like I'm not going to hold you, Steve. I was very close to getting to, like I've floated this take out to you before, like he should just have more top three consideration. I was very close to just going Mark Dadno at one because I just feel like his case has been severely slept on all year long. 64 wins, the best defense in the league, one of the best point differentials in regular season NBA history, despite at minimum 10 of your players missing at least 10 games, including the presumed MVP, is absolutely nonsensical. And I don't understand why he is just like, I know it's top three officially for the ballot. It just feels like he's like eighth for people. And I'm just like, how do you get there? They don't get to deal with. But to my actual top three, I do have Joe Mazzulla one, even though he doesn't want the award. That's okay. You're going to have it anyway. Joe Mazzulla at one. Boston top five on both ends of the floor per cleaning the glass. Mark Dadnotes two for me. I went Jordan Ott three. For this defense to go from 27th last year to 9th per cleaning the glass, for their offense to not really fall off despite the fact Devin Booker missed nearly 20 games, Dylan Brooks missed 26 games, Grayson Allen, your best 331, Jalen Green, your big acquisition from the KD trade, missed 50 games. Mark Williams missed 22. To have that level of consistency, to have to cycle through the amount of lineups that he had to do, and this team goes 45-37, it's kind of nuts to me. And so that's where he ends up getting the nod among other well-deserved cases. And so that's where I'm at. Quick salute to Jordan Knott. And finally, Steve, clutch player of the year, who did you have?
Shai Gilgeous-Alexander 1, Anthony Edwards 2, Nikola Jokic 3.
Oh, fascinating. Before I give my top three, because I feel like you were very heavily on the Anthony Edwards train, what eventually put Shai over Ant for you?
Ant missed time and Shai never stopped making every shot in clutch. It's pretty simple.
Fair enough. Top three for me, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, Jamal Murray, Anthony Edwards would be my top three. Quickly on Shai. First in scoring. Ninth in total assist, only turned the ball over 7 times, plus 93 in 125 clutch minutes, which is absolutely insane. And this is with him getting blitzed on over, I think, 17% of the pick and rolls that he saw in clutch time. Just did not matter if he sent 2 or not. He was getting to where he wanted to go. Insane season for him. Jamal Murray, one of my favorite stats as I was getting through this, went 17 of 28 on shots to tie or take the league in clutch here. Easily the most efficient scoring clip among guys that have taken at least 20 of those this year. Was just absolute nails for him. And then Anthony Edwards, who was leading the league in clutch scoring before he got hurt, and Shai took over there. But incredible shot making for him. The defense actually perked up for him in clutch moments. We would like for that to be more consistent throughout the game. But you did have a level of two-way play for Anthony Edwards as well. And so that's where we land. And that would be our ballots if we had official ones. NBA, come call us. Thank you, Steve, for reeling your picks. We can talk a little bit more about this off-ball. If you have comments, questions, et cetera, about what our picks would be, drop them in the comment section. Be respectful, but drop them in the comment section nonetheless. Beyond that, though, thanks for listening to and or watching this episode of The Dunker Spot. Subscribe if you haven't already. We are on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. Subscribe to the Yahoo NBA YouTube channel if you haven't already. You can follow me on socials at DekaiusNBA, Steve on socials at SteveJones20. And with that, we will catch y'all later in the week. We still got playoff stuff to talk about.